Accession number 1663, Reel 3.
Dr. Martin, Reel 3.
He said, well, just sit over there and the Colonel will see you. There was a pause, and then suddenly doors flew open, and I heard, everybody suddenly jumped to their feet, you see, and stood at attention, and the Colonel arrived. And this was Russia 1939. Behind him appeared an elderly man in a nondescript suit with a tiny little red button in his lapel, and he quietly sat down at the back somewhere. He was the political commissar of the unit. So the colonel said, Kabaritchi Ruski, you speak Russian. So I said, Trashko, a little. And so then somebody came up and told him, there is this captain, you see, who did the interpreting. So this man came along, this captain that I'd met before, and he took over my further questioning. They wanted to know why I was in Brest-Litovsk, and I explained my father's detention, my inability to get an exit permit, and my wish to go to Sweden, and from there to England. So that must have convinced them I was not a German spy arriving, they were very friendly, and he said, well, you can't do that. There's a war on. The Krasnaya Armada, the glorious Red Army, is liberating the oppressed people of Estonia and Latvia and Finland and whatnot. You can't go there. So I said, well, I'm staying with a friend, a former pupil of an uncle of mine, and I just have to wait there until the dust settles and I can travel. He said, yes, but how are you going to live? So I said, well, I have a little money. So they said, never mind. What about doing some work? So I said, well, if I can work as a doctor, I'd be delighted. So he said, well, you know, we don't, we are not popular with the Poles. They prefer the Germans to us. Our young people are in the forces. There's no difficulty. There's work for you, if you want it. So I said, yes, well, thank you. Where and when? So I said, well, we send you out tonight. Go off tonight. So I did. And I was put on a train which went into Belarus, towards Minsk. A bit further. River Terezina. But anyhow, I was sent to a what you would call cottage hospital, practically. I think 40 beds we had. And the doctor in charge, who was a surgeon with his assistants, was also the MOH for a district. Very hard work. And he didn't receive me with open arms. He would have preferred a properly qualified Russian doctor, of course. But you find, as a doctor, usually you learn your theoretical school medicine, and that in the end of it you find out you're probably good at some things, you see. Some people use a stethoscope and they hear much more than I do. Now, I had a very great sensitivity of my fingertips, in the sense that I never had any difficulty in giving an injection, an intravenous injection. You would think that's very easy. You put the needle into the vein, and then you draw a little blood, and you know you're in it. And then you take a deep breath and you're right through the vein and you have a big hematoma all around it. The same applies, of course, if you want to put in an airway during anesthetics, or if you want to give a spinal injection for local anesthetics. But anyhow, it's a neck. And the surgeon there, he found out that I was really very good in helping him to give him anesthetics, you see. And after that, you see, I was accepted, and I worked there for about 8 months. And they were very good to me. Now, then comes an event which was very important in my life. Being the sort of dog's body and junior, this young surgeon, well, he wasn't so young, 30s, I should think. He worked very hard, and he was just a little lazy, too. And so he hated one thing, and that was night calls. So who do you think had to do the night calls? So one night, it must have been just before Christmas, I was called out to see a child. And it turned out to be the daughter of a VIP. He was the Kulturny Commissar, Tovarish Lamontov. And my arrival there was far from promising, because when I arrived and presented myself, he said, "Well, who are you, and where's this lazy swine Lamontov? And why isn't he here? Where is he?" I said, "Well, he is off duty tonight, and he has been working, operating all day, and I'm a qualified doctor. I give you my opinion, and why not let me do this?" And he sort of blustered and said, "There's no point, you see, this is a surgical case, and you're no use to me. I sent the child up to the district hospital, and they'll deal with it, you see. Thank you." And then his wife, you see, talked to him and calmed him down and said something like, "Little father, you see, he's a doctor. He's a properly qualified doctor from Paris, and now that he's here, let him look at her." So, in due course, he agreed. And I saw, she must have been 14 girl. She was obviously in great pain. And it looked to me as a textbook case of acute appendicitis. You more or less had only to look at her tummy and she already shrank. She had a temperature. She had been sick, and you had only to touch the skin, and she sort of was in great distress. There are one or two localizing signs you try, which I tried to do very delicately. But in the end, you see, this seemed to confirm my ideas. And I said to him, "Well, she has to have an operation. She has an acute appendix, and it must be operated on quickly." He said, "Well, there you are, you see, I told you. It's just waste of time. We have the sleigh ready, you see, and we take her down to the district hospital in Pskov." And I said, "Well, sir, this will never do. She won't survive it. She'd be in deep shock. The temperature is minus 20, and it is 15-20 verst, you see. She wouldn't have a chance. You have your hospital, you have a decent surgeon there within 3 or 4 minutes, and that is the place to take her to." So I was sent up to wake up my colleague and get him ready. Not popularly said, why did you get this man? He hates me, and he criticized me, and why didn't you let him go and take her down there to the district hospital? That's what he wanted. So I explained. So in due course you said, well, all right, you see, get her ready, you see, and get her under, and then we'll have a look. So I started giving the anesthetic, and he arrived. And to tell this story against myself, the greatest embarrassment of my life, she was getting under an ether, open ether anesthetic, and the tummy collapsed, you see, and there was a little lump, like a little ping pong ball, on the side visible. So my colleague, you see, he sort of giggled and said, "This must be the appendix doctor," you see, and so I said, "Well, I'm very sorry, but it was an acute abdomen." Says, "Well, never mind. We have a look." And he opened her up, you see, and it was a torsion of the ovary. The ovary is hung up by strands of tissue with nerves and veins and blood vessels, and it had twisted round, and it was shut off from its blood supply and had started to swell and become necrotic, and it was in the place where I expected the appendix to be. So he said, "Well, we have to take this out, you see," and he cut off the blood supply and so on, and neatly removed it. Then he lifted up something like a little runner bean and said, "And there, Dr. Martin, Dr. Vutsilka, is your appendix." So I said, "Yes, it looks all right." So he said, "Well, you better take it out too," you see, and took it out. So the next morning, being a gentleman, he said to Commissar Lermontov, everybody was delighted with us. The girl was already free of pain, the temperature was settling. His mother wanted to kiss my hands, and he gave me a big bear hug, you see. And the surgeon, who was suddenly the flavor of the month, you see, he said, "Well, we took the appendix out, but we found also there was this ovary was unhealthy, and we had to take that out too. But anyhow, she can have children, no problem, she'd be fine." And she was. And after that, of course, I couldn't do anything wrong. Everybody was very kind. In fact, I had to be very tactful because they suggested I should go to Leningrad and study for a Russian degree. And I had to explain there was my family and father and so on. So in the end, I got a big document saying that I had been a good boy, and I was paying my wages, which I couldn't spend on anything anyhow. And with a fistful of rubles, I arrived in Lithuania at the end of March, 40. Well, there was an organization run by the Czech Refugee Trust Fund, whom I contacted, and in due course, they arranged for me. My visa was checked and was still valid. And I flew from Riga to Stockholm, and from Stockholm I went by air. No, from Stockholm I went by air to Norway, and I arrived on the last but one convoy from Norway in Newcastle on April the 3rd, 1940. And arriving, I was told that as I was 9 months late, of course, somebody else had taken my place at the Westminster Hospital. And my father, whom I contacted, realized I had to earn my living somehow. And through his sending me to somebody, I started assembling some little wireless sets as a technician. But anyhow, this was a matter of weeks. And then I got three letters within 10 days, more or less. I got a letter from the Czech Refugee Trust Fund saying that the Westminster Hospital felt it was very unfair to me and that they would have me as a student after all. Then I got a letter saying that my degree, particularly the Basho, the baccalaureate from the Sorbonne, was recognized and I would be able to practice medicine under supervision, which means I would be able to work in a hospital as a doctor. And finally, I got a letter from the Czech embassy. I'd visited the Czech embassy volunteering, you see. And they said they had no use for me. They had enough officers. What they wanted was soldiers. And they offered me to retain my rank as a sergeant in the 2nd Infantry Brigade. And I said, no, thank you very much. You see, I had now studied at 2 universities to be a doctor, and I only wanted to practice medicine. So they said, well, they couldn't, I had to be a volunteer, they couldn't tell me what to do, but they would notify the Royal Army Medical Corps if, as my qualifications, they had any interest in me. So the third letter was to report for a medical at Fleet in Hampshire. And in due course, I first worked in an EMS hospital, an emergency hospital, as a doctor in Essex for a few months, and then I joined the RAMC.
Where did you serve in the RAMC?
Everywhere. I was in 92, I was sent to Northern Ireland. As I had served with a cavalry regiment, I was sent to the Blues and Royals in Donaghadee in Northern Ireland. And then, approved by the colonel, I volunteered to join the commandos. I didn't very much want to do the commandos are not the airborne troops. And so this was in the making, my reporting for training. But then the pathologist at the military unit in Queen Victoria Hospital in Belfast fell very ill, and I was sent to the path lab there to look after it until some replacement could be found. They seemed to be short of pathologists at the time. And I had been a demonstrator in pathology for a very famous man, Professor Gone. So anyhow, I worked there for a while, and they made me then what is called a graded physician. And after that, I haven't any more to do with the actual fighting troops. And I did hospital work ever since. But by God, everywhere. I was posted to Goodwood, where they were setting up small unit hospitals to be mobile with their own transport to go over to France on D3, which we did. And with them I went to Belgium, to Board of Holland. But though I was posted and on the strengths of this hospital for a year or two, they keep careful records. So my knowledge of French and German was known to them, and my knowledge a bit of Russian. So I was constantly posted away. The things I did was I went for a time to Rouen, where there was a Canadian, an American, and a British medical officer dealing with claims via French GPs, claims against the military, people run over by army transport, things like that, to work out compensations. Then I was posted for a time to an army prison. Now, an army prison is something quite unbelievable. To be sent to prison, you had to be a murderer or a serial rapist or somebody quite wild. And so they got accommodation in the provincial prison, the French prison in Douai, and I was posted to them to liaise for a month or two. God, I was pleased when I was able to leave them.
Why was it so unpleasant for you?
Well, you went through various screens and the people were quite horrible, the people I looked after. And you had constant to have armed guards behind you because there's a lot of aggression and it was a very sad place, a fierce place. But their crime sheets were of course incredible. They were a very bad lot. And the people who looked after them as warders and so on, in army uniform, they were a very rough lot too. But anyhow, I was with them 6-8 weeks. But then, more interesting, I was sent up to Edinburgh, and there was briefed to go to Tromsø in Arctic Norway to sort out some hundreds of Russian prisoners of war who had been treated like cattle or worse. And then also I had had to contact the quartermaster general of the German occupying forces to requisition certain things we needed. The war was still going on in the Far East, to requisition binocular microscopes, things like that. Now I found then that actually there weren't Germans there, but there were Austrian troops, Alpenjäger, and they fell over backwards to be cooperative. They wanted to make us believe that they really were liberated by us too, that they never were Germans, they were Austrians who had been misled. Anyhow, when I came back...
Before you just leave the Russian prisoners, can you tell me more about what you experienced of them in Tromsø?
Well, I liaised with their medical officers, and we had drinking sessions together, and we were all great friends. The one thing of interest was that I mentioned, of course, that I had been near Minsk and a place called Pskov for a few months. And I said, well, what do you think happened to them? And they said, oh, my dear boy, you were in luck. That is now like a moon landscape. It was first conquered by the Germans and reconquered by the Russians, then retaken by the Germans. It was all part of the ring around Leningrad, you know, where the weather and the desperate fighting, you see, meant there was nothing left standing. So nobody living there would have made it.
Did the Russian POWs wish to go back to the USSR?
Well, you see, it's a bit difficult. You see, I talked to them hardly ever on their own, you see. But they were very cheerful. They were very pleased to get away from Tromsø. You see, they were kept in barracks. There were four shelves, like storage shelves, you see. And they had a sort of space of only a few cubic feet each. And they had hardly any medicines at all, you see. They were just underfed and undertreated. And now they suddenly were sorted out and treated like human beings. So there was certainly no opposition to their going.
You were telling me about their opposition to being treated with DDT.
Oh, well, they had their reluctance to let any official do something to them. And so though we explained, you see, that this was simply to their advantage, they were very primitive, very uneducated lot, you see. They might have thought it would make them impotent or something mad, you see. They just took against it. So they had some people who said, well, I do it for you. And we saw the same face on four or five occasions. And then it really dawned even on me that we had to do something about it. And we had then a sort of rubber stamp with violet ink, and we put it in the palms to say they had really been done. And that dealt with it. But then I went back to England, reported back, and I was sent to... I would say this perhaps. I had done some good, and the CO was a very nice old chap. He said, well, my boy, you really were of considerable help to us. And I got two or three decorations I can give, but it would be no use to you, even mention dispatches, you see, because you are a war substantive officer, you see. The people who would have amount to tremendous benefit is the ones who are regulars. So I said, well, sir, I quite agree, you see. I said, well, it won't be to your disadvantage, you see. So we hand out two OBEs and to the 30th General and two minor things, but you leave it to me. And so I was sent to East Africa and gazetted a major, promoted. And there I had a fabulous time because I worked for the son of a famous father, the big chief in tropical medicine in Britain then was a man called Professor Manson Barr. Textbook of medicine, Manson Barr. His son Clifford was colonel in charge of the medical division of the hospital in East Africa where I was posted to. And he liked to go on safari and do interesting things. And he said, well, Harry, you'll be all right. And I'll be back in a few days. And so half the people thought, attending, that I was really in charge. He was a sort of just a visitor. And the war was over in Europe by then. And to make use of our hospital, which was underemployed, the local GPs were allowed to send in their cases for ECGs, X-rays, laboratory investigations at the hospital, on the understanding that the resident physician, which was me, would see the patients in their habitat. And so with my little jeep, I went all over for months and months in the highlands. I visited coffee plantations and tea plantations and whatnot.
This is in Kenya?
In Kenya, you see. I was there for just over a year. And then, as a medical specialist, a major, occasionally acting lieutenant colonel, I was sent up to North Africa. And I worked then in the canal zone for another year as a medical specialist.
Was there any question of your returning to Czechoslovakia?
Well, this came up, you see, but one thing I should mention also, that I had a sort of feedback, people I knew, people who had started going back after 1945 to Czechoslovakia, partly even from the Czech embassy in London. And I had a few acquaintances there. And the information I got was utterly depressing. Anybody who had spent the war in the West was non-Jew. And having served in the British forces would be worse still. So I mentioned this to my commanding officer. And